All right, good morning. Happy Friday. Let's see. So what I was thinking for today was pretty similar to what we did last time. So just to look over very briefly the problems that we did last time to see if there were further thoughts, and then do an old exam. And then I wanted to look at spectra today. And so the usual situation here is going to be bounded operators on Hilbert spaces. And once again, I think I'll just talk a little bit about what some of the main techniques are in spectra and then go to a collection of problems. And in fact, today I have a whole bunch of problems, so I'm sure we won't get through them all. Also, let's see, I guess I got the recordings to work. So let me know if you have issues with those, but those should be available now on the web page. Let's see. Okay, any other thoughts or questions? Okay, let's just then look briefly at the problems that we did last time just to see what thoughts people have had. So let me do what I've done before and try to link it. Of course, it's in the on the web page as usual, and there's the link. And now I should be able to share it. Okay, so let's see. So these are the ones that we looked at last time, I believe. Okay, and let's see, so just running through these quickly to remind ourselves what they were. So okay, here we go. All right, so let's see, so for this first one, we talked through most of that. Did anyone have any further thoughts about whether the discussion that we had could be written up cleanly or not? Okay. And let's see. So then the this next one. So this one, we sort of talked about how you might approach it, and we got various near approximations to an answer. Did anyone actually work this one out and get the this sum equal to a half to work? Okay, well, that might be a fun one for somebody to try at some point, just to see. Because there were a couple of different ideas for how you might get it, right? Either plugging in a value or using the isometry. Okay, and let's see. So then the Heisenberg one, I guess we worked that one out in some detail. So I don't know if anyone has any comments about that one. And let's see, this one. I think that one we did, we talked about it some. We didn't do it in complete detail, but I hope we said enough to do it. Did anyone try to write up the details on that one? Okay. Okay, and this last one I think we worked out pretty completely. Okay, so if there are no thoughts about the problems that we looked at yesterday, then let me bring up an exam and do what we've done with it before. So once again, the best thing to do is to run through and figure out a first initial approach to it and just how difficult you think it'll be. So you know which ones are the ones to get started on and which ones are the ones to probably wait until you've got a whole bunch already finished. Okay, once again, let's try I'll give you a few minutes, but if you could do something, I don't know, raise your hand or push the little green yes or put a comment in the comment box or something when you're ready to start talking through them. That would be helpful. Okay. So, exam, and we'll also put it in the box here. Okay. And of course, let me know if you have any questions about the problems or if you have trouble seeing the problems. All right, looks like a couple of people are about ready to look at this. All right, looks like we have about a majority now. Okay, all right, that looks like a majority. All right, so let's try looking these over. So, all right, so with the first one, so what type of thing is that? So this is sort of a convergence problem like the ones that we're looking at before. So did anyone have any thoughts about how you might approach it? Or no.
Looks like just using definitions doesn't seem like any tricks.
Okay. So so that would probably be for the to show that it's actually continuous for A, and then check that it converges pointwise. So then, yeah, so those are you can probably what is totally bounded related to?
Compactness.
Exactly. Yeah. So if we have totally bounded, so there's a theorem that. Yeah, that tries. You have good. It's related to that. So if you have a good, totally bounded set, then it can be pre-compact. So this is a yes or no question. So if you're trying to show, for example, that it's not totally bounded, you might end up just doing it by showing that it lacks compactness, for example. So that's the only thing that I can think of here, which might not be just a direct computation. Okay. All right. What about number two? That's a metric space problem, but so what? How might people approach this?
Just use the definition of complete?
Probably so, yeah. So if you use the definition of complete and try something like a contrapositive, then you'd have, so you have to sort of think through how you might use something about every continuous function complete. So when you see something like every, you might also think about the contrapositive, where if you say it's not complete, then you can construct a function. So those are the two approaches I might consider.
Oh, I think if you have a Cauchy sequence that has no limit point, then that's a closed subset of the metric space. And you can use the Tietz extension theorem to make a continuous function with any values you want on that sequence.
That sounds
good. And in particular, you can make it unbounded.
Right. Exactly. That sounds like exactly the right sort of thing to do. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. So use an extension theorem and the contrapositive. Right. Okay. Very good. Other thoughts on that one? All right. What about number three? Right. Well, I guess it's some sort of monic system. So actually, just noting it, when do you get the converse here, where weakly convergent sequences go to strongly convergent ones? So those are compact operators. So this is kind of the converse of the compact ones. They're all bounded. Okay, sounds like there are no comments on that one. All right, and what about number four here? Okay, so it looks like maybe an Arzelà-Ascoli to get our compactness. So what kind of operator is this A here? Okay. Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure how I would use that. But this class of operators, actually, we'll look at them a little bit today. These are integral operators, and this K is usually called the integrating kernel. And it's a common class. Okay, and there's a, is there any theorems about when those are compact? Bounded suffices here, right? What you actually need is L2 bounded. You have bounded finite that they're in L2. Okay, so this would probably use that theorem. A is compact if K is in L2 right, and bounded in particular is sufficient, right? Okay, so that's one you probably want to know that theorem. All right, what about five? Well, this is pretty much prove a theorem which is in the textbook, so it's just a reminder that you should look through the major theorems, I guess. That's a standard theorem, which we talked about last time. Okay, and let's see, and what about the last one? Does that one require any tricks, or can you just sort of do that one directly by hand? Any thoughts? Okay, well, so I mean, I call this another convergence problem, and I would have in my pocket examples of those. So just so that one should be. Okay, all right, so once again, why don't we just try again, either annotating or putting in the chat box or something, which ones you think are easiest and which ones you think are hard ones. Anyone else have thoughts? Okay, yeah, so several people think that number two is going to be straightforward. Okay, all right. We sort of went through a proof for two, so if you see the proof, then I guess that one's short to write up. Right, so several people thought that was easy. And again, for a problem like six, it's just good to sort of have a list of examples of how they converge, just in mind. Okay, any other thoughts or comments about this exam before we look at spectra? Okay, so maybe I'll just briefly run through a few facts about spectra, and then we can look at some problems. So again, the spectra that that we mostly see are for operators on bounded operators on Hilbert spaces. Okay, and so just run through a bit of notation, and maybe you can help me out if you know these. So first of all, the spectrum. So if we have X A, say a bounded operator in a Hilbert space, then the write the spectrum for the points where it's not invertible. and rho for the complement of that. Standard notation. And the way that I like to think about something not being invertible is to think about the factorization. So if you have an operator A that takes H to itself, you can always factor it into first the map to the image. So this is our operator A. So first you can go to the image of A. So by definition, that's surjective. And then that embeds, but since we have a topology, it first can be embedded into the closure of the image. And then that can be embedded into H. So the first is dense and the second is closed in embeddings. And if you think of these as say one, two, and three here, these three pieces of your map, for A to be invertible, each of those has to be invertible. And so we name the spectrum by which of those are invertible. Okay, so which are invertible? And then the name. So one, two, and three can be invertible or not invertible. And so the nicest one, I guess the easiest one is the point or eigenvectors or eigenvalues. And so does anyone know which of those three maps must be not invertible to have an element of the point spectrum or an eigenvalue for A? Right, so we have this which is which could have a kernel, and these that might not be onto. Does that make sense? So if I have a point spectrum or something where I have an eigenvalue, what does that mean? That means that there's something in the kernel of my map, right? Yes, number one, exactly, right. So that means that number one is not invertible, right? So in this, so to get an eigenvalue or a point, we have that this is not invertible, okay? But these are invertible. Maybe I shouldn't use X's, I should use Y's and N's to make it clearer. So this is not invertible, nope. But these, actually, it doesn't matter whether those are, sorry. So these can be either invertible or not invertible. And you end up with an element of the point spectrum. Okay, and then, but there are other ways things can go wrong. And so the residual spectrum is what you get when the map is not, the image is not dense. Okay, so you have something in the complement. And so that's co-kernel. So this is where this one is not invertible. Okay, and the notation is given such that if it's in the point spectrum, you say it's in the point spectrum, and you only call it in the residual if it's not in the point spectrum. So that one must be invertible. Okay. And then the continuous spectrum is the rest. So continuous is the things where there's no kernel, there's no co-kernel, but the image is not dense. I'm sorry, it's not closed. Okay, so those are the types of spectrum. And so for example, then we look at special classes of operators. So for instance, they're finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And if it's finite dimensional, what happens? Well, the only thing that can happen is that you can have a kernel. And when you have a kernel, you also have a co-kernel, right? Because there's a concept of rank. And so those are, I just put it backwards. So these can both, these would have to both be not invertible, and that one always is. So everything is always closed. Okay, and let's see, other types of operators that come up a lot are things that are self-adjoint, for example. Okay, and for those, you can have point spectrum, so it might be not invertible here, right? But then you'll also have something in the co-kernel. And then this could be either way. And you can also have something where it's only the middle one that's not invertible. Okay, and then there are other popular operators to keep in mind. So there's shift operators, and you can work out what their spectrum is like. There's multiplication operators, and there are these integral operators like the one that we just saw. Okay. All right, and then there are some theorems about spectra. So for example, the spectrum. So does anyone know what the spectrum of the adjoint looks like to an operator? Nope. So what a junction does is it switches one and three, and also takes a complex conjugate. That's right. So it's and it takes this one back to itself. So it switches the type, but it doesn't change the spectrum except by the complex conjugate. So as you're correct, so this is equal to the complex conjugate of the original spectrum, right? But again, the type changes. So if we had something that was just residual spectrum, then it becomes a point spectrum. Okay. So the residual, so the residual spectrum of an operator conjugated then is contained in the point spectrum of the adjoint. But that, again, you can see just by understanding this picture here and the fact that the adjoint switches these two. Okay, and let's see, so then there are other things you can do. So what about the spectrum of the inverse? Okay, so there's kind of a general picture. You can take if F maps the spectrum of A to C continuously, there is a new operator F of A, and the spectrum of F of A is equal to F of the spectrum of A. Okay. And this, the inverse is an example of that. So this is one over the spectrum of A. And by that, I mean just the set of all one over lambda such that lambda is in the spectrum of A. Okay. Okay, so there are some sort of useful facts about spectra in general. Okay. And then the main theorem that in this thing is the spectral theorem, but the one that gets used the most in this class is the spectral theorem for compact self-adjoint operators. So this is, I think, theorem 9.16 in Hunter Nachtigal. And that's the spectral theorem for compact self-adjoint operators. Okay, and it says that if we have a compact self-adjoint operator, then it's mostly point spectrum, then the spectrum of K is a has only one possible concentration point, which is zero. Yeah, so it's going to be contained in R with only one concentration point. Possible at zero. Okay, and for non-zero and non-zero elements. So if I take the spectrum and remove zero, then those are all a point. And K can be rewritten as a just as a sum of these lambda n times the projection to the this the eigenspace for lambda n. Okay, so there's this nice structure term. Let's see, some other useful facts. Okay, so then there are also general facts theorem. The spectrum of if we have a self-adjoint, I'm sorry, if we just have an operator, so A is a bounded operator, then the spectrum is open, is closed, and non-empty. Okay, so that's another useful fact. Let's see. From the analysis that we had over here, you can see that if you have something that is self-adjoint, since the since we understood what happens to the adjunction, we know that the spectrum is real. And by a similar argument, if it's unitary, then the spectrum is contained in the unit circle. Okay. So various useful facts. Okay, and I guess there's one other thing that comes up quite often in these problems, and that is that the norm of the operator is related, and there are two ways that that comes in. So theorem, the radius of A is the smallest, is the radius containing the spectrum, and this is also equal to the limit of the norms of a to the n, to the one over n, and in some cases it's actually just the norm itself. In particular, if it's a self-adjoint, then the radius is just equal to the norm of A. So that's another useful fact. And then finally, there are ways to construct inverses, and that's the Neumann series. It's more of a technique than a theorem. And so, for example, if I want to find one is not in the spectrum of A, then I can write down this Neumann series. So A minus the identity is invertible, e.g. 1 over A minus the identity is equal to the sum of all the powers of A. And so, and this will converge in strong operator topology. Okay, so that's how you might go about actually building these inverses and showing that something's not in the spectrum. Okay, that was a very brief overview of spectral theory. Any comments or questions? Okay, hopefully it'll make more sense when we look at some actual problems. Okay, so if there are no comments, then I will move to some problems. And these, of course, are the ones linked on the page, as usual. So let me put in the link. Okay, that's right, and then share the page. Okay, so here's a good example. As usual, if you have questions about the meaning of anything, or please ask immediately, and otherwise let's just take a couple minutes and then see what thoughts people have just as an initial approach to the problem, and then a few more minutes to try to make that work. Okay. And again, feel free to use the green or the hand when you're ready to do that initial vetting of what techniques you're going to use. Okay, let's see. Does anyone maybe use the red no if you want another minute before we take some initial ideas for how people are approaching it? Okay, all right. So so what thoughts did people have about this one as a first approach? All right, well, let's take another minute then and see if you can think of something to use for this one. Okay, all right, let's try again. So just based on the exam that we just looked at, what can we say about this operator? Yes, so we already know that it's compact. So from exam, K is compact. Okay, since it's this integral operator, with kernel f of x and y equals this piece in here, xy1 minus xy, all right. Okay, very good. So, and so the compact, the classification theorem for compacts holds. So that's limiting already. Okay, anyone see anything else about it? Is it self-adjoint, for example? Yes, and how would I see that? Since let me just write down a general fact. The kernel is symmetric in x and y and real, exactly. So if I take any integral operator k with a kernel f of x y, the adjoint is always just given by taking, you just switch the roles of x and y and take the complex conjugate. And in this case, this is equal to f of yx, because the x and y, as you said, are symmetric, and it's real. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have two things. So it's compact and self-adjoint. And let's see, do we know anything else about this operator? What happens if I just pull all the x's out of my integral? So I can just write this as the integral is just in y, right? So I can just pull them out. So this will be x times integral from 0 to 1 of y f of y dy minus x squared times the integral of y squared f of y dy. Right. So the answer is going to be it's going to be a quadratic. Choose a little hard to read. Right, so we're just going to get a quadratic polynomial in the answer. The image is contained in quadratic polynomials. It might help us to find the eigenvalues correct. Okay, and what's the dimension of the space of quadratic polynomials? So to me, the key point is that this is a finite dimensional space. Right, we started in this L2 of 0, 1, which is an infinite dimensional space, but this image just lies in this finite dimensional space. Okay, and actually, so you suggested here be helpful to find an eigenvalue. So, are you able then to find an eigenvalue for k using this? Well, maybe that's something to try. It's a good suggestion. So maybe everyone can just try to find an eigenvector and therefore eigenvalue for k. So maybe a little green symbol or hand if you can see how you would go about finding an eigenvector and could therefore spend a minute or so doing it. Okay, a couple people. All right. So maybe, yeah, so maybe since no one else seems to be putting up the green thing, how, maybe you could tell us then how you would go about trying to find an eigenvector for K. Right, exactly. Yeah, as in the chat box there, you know that if it's going to be an eigenvector, then it has to be in the image, and the image is only things of the form written there. So one is going to have to take a f equal to exactly as written ax squared plus bx, plug it into the equation, and solve for an a and a b. Why don't people just try that for a second, just to see if that makes sense. Okay, so why don't people try that and just let me know when you find an eigenvalue. Okay, so someone in the chat box got some numbers. So answer, let's see, we're at 1 over root 3 and, 1 over root 5. Okay, and in doing that, did you also get a eigenvector out of it? Just, I mean, not that you actually need it, but like you would have. Okay. Okay. So did anyone else get that? I mean, we can also try to rewrite it in terms of inner products, if you prefer that over the notation of integrals. So if we rewrite this as inner products, this is x times the L2 inner product of y with f of y minus x squared times the L2 inner product of y squared with f of y. And I'm afraid, Gavin, that I'm getting at something different. If I plug in x for f, I'm going to get that this integral, that this second integral here is non-zero, right? Because we're integrating from 0 to 1. Right, yeah. You're orthogonalized, right? Okay, but also since now we're studying a map between two-dimensional vector spaces, what's another way to represent this operator K? Is that clear? So it's essentially the computation you just did. It's just given by some 2x2 matrix in this basis x and x squared, right? Right, and it'll give you something like a third minus a quarter, and a fifth. Some sign errors, sorry. Yep. Okay, so I'm not sure if anyone is following this. Okay, so we've ended up then with this operator whose image is two-dimensional. Okay, and this matrix that we've found here is going to have we can just find the eigenvalues of that matrix, exactly, right? And it's going to have either one or two, right? Like any two-dimensional matrix has. All right. And once we do that, how close are we then to finding the spectrum of the original operator? So the spectrum, which has eigenvalues, lambda 1 and lambda 2. Okay. And then to get to the actual answer, that's the entire point spectrum, exactly, right? That's right. And 0 is the only other possibility for the spectrum itself, right? And what does it mean to have 0 in the spectrum? So note 0 is in the spectrum of A if and only if
K is or K is an invertible?
Right. A is not invertible. Or I guess we call it K, right? So is not invertible. Okay, and could this operator K here possibly be invertible?
No, because it maps into 2D space, right?
Exactly right. We're taking this infinite dimensional space all the way down to a little two-dimensional space, so it couldn't possibly be invertible. And A and K is not invertible. Okay, so then we've got the spectrum, right? So it's got this lambda 1 and the lambda 2, and also 0, right? So then the answer is going to be that the spectrum of K is equal to the eigenvalues of this specific 2x2 matrix and 0, right? And whatever it turned out to be, you just got it by plugging in. I forget, 1/3, 1/4, minus 1/4, minus 1/5, I think. Okay, so this 2x2 matrix. Does that make sense, everyone? Okay, and then it says to classify, and these two are point spectrum, right? Because that's what we just worked out. And finally, there's zero, and if we go back to the possibilities, there are three possibilities, right, for the spectrum, for any spectrum. It could, when it says classify, it means point, or residual, or continuous. And what do we know? Is it point?
What was the question? Are you asking if zero is in the point spectrum?
Correct, because the question here says to classify the spectrum, right? And we've found eigenvectors for these two, right? So we know they're in the point spectrum. To complete the problem, we have to, the last thing to do is to identify which of those three types of spectrum zero is.
Zero is in the point spectrum because it fails to be injective, right?
Correct. So the whole thing is point. Okay, so does that make sense? So this is turns out to be a relatively benign compact self-adjoint operator. And thank you. Yes, someone wrote in the chat, Gavin also wrote here in the chat box that we can be more explicit and identify elements of the kernel. Because it's just anything that's orthogonal in L2 to x and x squared. Right. Okay, so does this make sense? Any questions about this problem? Okay, pretty good. So let's move on to the next thing. So, another popular type of operator. Okay, so again, yes, please just read through it, and if you then once you're ready to at least give at least just a brief idea of what to do, give me a green or a thumbs or something, and we can talk briefly, and then we can continue thinking about it a little bit. Okay, let's see. Does anyone want another minute before running through some brief ideas on how to approach it? Okay, so look for ideas. Actually, let me just make a couple of comments. So multiplication, so the picture that I like for integral operators is just matrix multiplication, just like we just saw actually a second ago. So where I have my function of x and y here, and I think of my function f, and then I just do sort of a matrix multiplication, end up with k sub f of f. So it's essentially what it is, right? When I do this kernel operation, and multiplication operators like the one that we're looking at here are the case where instead of a function, you have something that looks like a function times a delta function along the diagonal. Okay, so they're sort of related. So this is a multiplication by some g. Okay, so anyway, I think of them as being related. Okay. Anyway, we're asked to show that M is bounded. And then we're asked to show something about the spectrum. And then we're asked something about the spectral type. Okay, so did anyone have any thoughts about any of those three things?
If lambda is not in the closure of M, the image of M, mm-hmm. then the inverse of big M is just the multiplication operator, or sorry, the inverse of M minus lambda I is just the multiplication operator by 1 over M of x minus lambda,
very
which
good.
Is a continuous bounded function.
Oops, sorry, my notation is bad, but you said it correctly. So let me just tidy my notation to agree with what you just said. So I just named the function, and it should be instead the multiplication operator on that function. So this is equal to the multiplication operator, like you said, associated with the function 1 over m of x minus lambda, just as you said. And this function down here, as you noted, is continuous and bounded, right? As long as we're not in the closure, right? So if we're in the closure, then we're too close and we don't have that. So you explicitly gave an inverse, and so that gives us that the spectrum is contained in where it's supposed to be. Okay, everyone happy with that argument? Good, all right. So that gives us one of the two derivatives. So I guess spectrum given by, so there are two parts to it, should containment this way and containment that way. And so now we've done, oops, the other one. Right. Oh no, sorry, I circled the right one. Okay. So I'm labeling these. So this is part A, part B, part C, and part D. And this here is an argument for part B. Right, pretty good. So any thoughts on A, C, or D?
I had an idea for the other inclusion.
Okay.
So if you take some x0, you know, in the real numbers, you want to show that m of x0 is in the spectrum. So what you can do is take a some step functions.
Okay.
At kind of shrink towards x0. So you take like the closed interval from x0 minus 1 over n to x0 plus 1 over n.
Okay.
You let that be like fn. And then you look at the limit in L2 as n goes to infinity of m minus m0x I applied to fn. And it should go to 0 because it's m is continuous. That's the idea, at least.
Okay, let's see. So I'm sorry, I missed part of it. I was trying to figure out how to erase. So so the minimum as the limit is n goes to infinity, and then what was it again?
It's m minus m of x zero I applied to fn.
Okay. Okay.
Trying to show that the resolvent is not bounded.
Right. Okay. Applied to and I see. Yeah. So you found a sequence of functions, and so this should be then the resolvent. So minus x zero. I.
Okay. M of x zero.
What have I left out here?
Instead of x zero, it's just m of x zero.
Ah. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Getting confused here. So limit, so you're going to apply it to f of n, and oh, I see, I understand. Okay, got it. So this should be m of x zero. Got it. Okay, so
I'm not sure if it worked properly.
But that's an idea of something that would be a witness that the thing was not invertible there. Okay.
I had an idea for C also, but
okay.
I'm not sure if it works. So, okay. I mean, can you just say lambda is in the image of M.
Okay.
Then when you apply, when you do M minus lambda I, it's going to be zero at lambda, mm-hmm. Or zero at whatever maps to lambda. Mm-hmm. It's going to be zero somewhere, which means that in the image, you can never get a function. All of your functions in the image are going to be zero at that point.
I see. Okay.
Problem with this argument is that everything is only up to almost everywhere. So I don't know if you can adapt this to make sense.
Right, I see. Okay,
so I'm trying to say it's not surjective because everything in the image is zero at that point.
Right. So these are functions vanishing at. So in particular, let's say lambda is equal to m of x. Say.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
And then for the closure part, it's just like at infinity. It's the same idea.
But it
doesn't really work because things are only defined up to almost everywhere. So I'm not sure if you can fix that.
Okay. Actually, there we can deal with the closure just very easily. How do we deal with just the closure part? If we got every point inside
Is the spectrum always closed?
The spectrum's always closed, right? So that's a theorem you can just use. So just recall that the spectrum is always closed. So it suffices to show that just the image is in there. Okay. So those are some good approaches, I think, to that. What about A and D? Is A difficult?
You can just set up the integral for A, right? And then just pull out that constant. Yeah.
Right. So you think this one you can just do by some direct integral check. Yeah, so actually, what do we have to check for part A, for the fact that the operator is bounded? On L2.
We just need to show that the L2 normal of MF is bounded by, is less than or equal to some constant times the L2 norm of F for all F.
Correct. And how hard is that going to be? So this would be the soup over the, as you say, the L2 norm of MF, which is just MXF, divided by the L2 norm of F. So this will just be soup over the integral of m squared f squared dx. And do we know that that's bounded?
Yes, because m is bounded, so you can just...
Exactly. So we just
less than or equal to a constant times...
Precisely. So just the soup of m squared, right? So that's going to be our bound. Okay, so that gives us A. So A is straightforward. The fact that it's closed is straightforward. We figured out an argument for B. All right, so C we have two good ideas for that need some fleshing out. And what about D? Any thoughts about D? What would an eigenvector look like?
It would have to satisfy m of x, f of x equals lambda f of x for all x.
Mm-hmm.
But that would mean that, that would mean that either f of x is 0 or m of x equals lambda for each specific x.
Okay, and could there be such an example? This is for D. Yeah, that's exactly the correct analysis. And so what are we going to need? We just need that M is a constant on some set of a positive measure. Okay, so does that make sense? So this can happen if only if M inverse of lambda has positive measure. So in other words, if, for example, if little m is just a constant function, then any function works. Every function is an eigenfunction. Every function is an eigenvector, I guess. Okay, so that's pretty complete. So the arguments for C, I think, will work. It just need to be fleshed out a bit. And otherwise, I think we got all the other parts. Any questions or thoughts about this one? Okay, and again, this is another class of functions that one should be, operators that come up a lot, and so it's the kind that one should be familiar with, along with the interval operators and the ones in the next problem. So if there are no further questions about this, so let's look at another one.
Oh, wait, I thought eigenvectors cannot be zero, so f of x cannot be zero, right?
That's right. So if f of x itself were zero everywhere, that would not be allowed, right. But f can be zero at a particular point, that's fine, as long as it's not itself the zero vector.
I see.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. And that's why we need positive measure here, right? Because otherwise you could write down f's, but they would be equivalent to zero. Okay, other questions or comments about this one? All right, so then let's look at the next one here. So, this is another example that should be familiar because it comes up a lot. So once again, yeah, just spend a couple minutes trying to figure out how you might approach this and ask you if you have any questions. Okay, are people getting somewhere? Does anyone have any ideas on how to approach either the R or the L?
I have an idea for L, I think.
Okay.
Isn't it the case that every number is in the spectrum for L?
Okay.
So, No. Well, okay. I'm just thinking about because essentially the first entry in the input.
Mm-hmm. This X1?
Yeah, because mm-hmm. that gets shifted left. Uh-huh. When you have L minus lambda I, there's going to be more than one thing that maps to zero. And so it's not going to be injective.
I see.
I haven't fully fleshed out this idea, but.
Okay.
If you write down that eigenvalue equation, Lx equals lambda x, then what you get is a recurrence relation for the x's. You get xn plus 1 equals lambda times xn. And that's solvable. That just means xn equals x naught times e to the lambda n. Oh, sorry. Lambda to the n.
Right.
Correct. And that's a. But the only thing is, we need this x to be in L2. And so the only lambdas for which that's possible is. Modulus of lambda is strictly less than 1.
Right. Okay, so does that make sense to everyone? So he's just written down the eigenvectors for us. So things like 1, lambda, lambda squared, lambda cubed, etc. In fact, only things like that. And then when you shift it left, you get lambda times it. Okay, and did that go both ways? Does that not only give us examples, but give us all examples there? I believe it does, right? Because you wrote down, as you said, the eigenvector equation, and so these are in fact all the eigenvectors. So that means that the point spectrum of the left operator is equal to the set of all lambda such that the normal lambda is strictly less than 1. Okay, and what happens if you try the same thing for the right shift?
I think for R, there's just nothing in the point spectrum because if you you can kind of if R of something is a constant multiple of itself, you can kind of recursively show that everything is zero. So right. So since the first index of the image is zero, that means X1 had to be zero.
Mm-hmm.
If X1 is zero, that means X2 has to be zero. And so just your initial vector was zero.
Okay, very good. And actually, so as long as we're working on these, this is a very good example that one should know because it comes up a lot. And it's a good counterexample for lots of things. Maybe we can just, so we let's see, did we finish? Is that all it asked for? Yes, so we solved the problem, right? We're done, very good. All right, now, but as long as we're at it, is it clear what the full spectrum is for each of these operators? So could either one have only point spectrum
No.
No, right. Why not?
Well, it has to be non-empty and closed.
Exactly. And one side is one fails one and the other fails the other. Precisely. So so they both have to have some spectrum that's not this point spectrum. But just using the properties of spectra, can we figure out what the remaining spectrum must be? So first of all, there were two useful facts. So one is that it's related to the norm. And is it, does anyone know what the norm of all L and R are? Yes. And it's also true if it shifts a bunch of times. And so then we can use our theorem that says that the spectrum of L and also the spectrum of R are contained in the ball of radius, you know, the limit as n goes to infinity of the norm of L to the n, the 1 over n, but that's just 1. Okay, so we know that it's contained in the ball. So for L, then we're done, right? We know that the closed ball is the entire spectrum, because we know it has to be closed and has to be contained in that, right? And then also L and R are related. Anyone see how they're related? Exactly. They're adjoint. Okay, and we know that the spectrum of operator and its adjoint are related. So if the spectrum of L is the closed unit circle, then unit ball, then what is the spectrum of R? It's the same, right? So it's the complex conjugate of the same thing, which is the same thing. So it's equal to the spectrum of L bar, which is equal to the spectrum of L, which is equal to the closed unit ball. Okay, so we know from that short analysis, we get what the rest of the spectrum is, and from the detailed analysis we have to the eigenvectors, we figured out which part of that spectrum is point, and with a little more work, you can figure out what the remaining what the type is for the rest of the spectrum, and it's worth just trying at home just because it's a useful example to have in mind. Okay, any questions or thoughts about this one? Okay, so let's look at another. Okay, let's see. Are people getting anywhere? Any thoughts about either of these parts?
The first one I thought of relating the norm to the statement by the inner product, and maybe that would show something.
Okay. Sounds reasonable. Anyone else have thoughts? All right. That's encouraging. All right. And do you want to explain? Okay, just drop what you got there into the board, but people can also see it in the chat there. So the norm of t star x minus x squared is equal to this inner product. Okay. And the claim is that that you can compute and all right. And then where does the fact that the norm of the operator is less than or equal to one come in? Yeah, that's a little worrisome, yes. But if you have an argument that doesn't use it, we can try it and see if anyone can spot what went wrong.
I did norm T star x minus x squared. Equals you end up expanding the inner product and you get norm T star x squared minus two inner product T star x with x minus norm x squared.
Plus, right?
Yes, plus.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
You can write inner product T star X X as T star X TX because x is a fixed point.
That's right.
And then by the properties of adjoints, that's just equal to the inner product of x with x.
Okay. That could be where you're using it, right?
So, so you. Oh, I see.
Okay. No, now you're using that x as you're using the x as a fixed point again. That's what you're using.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, you can do that.
Okay. All right. So then this is then I agree.
Okay, and then. So, but you can also write that as T star TX inner product with T star TX, which is the same thing as the norm of T star X squared. Because X is a fixed point. And now that is also equal to, so I mean these, you basically have zero. Right, you have t star x squared minus 2 t star x squared plus t star x squared equals zero.
Okay. Let's see. Two.
My one thought would be that the intention was to have you use like contraction mapping or something to prove this instead of expanding the norm, in which case the operator being less than one would be important. But this in some sense might be more more general.
Right. Yeah, actually I'm still not quite seeing how it works out because I see a T star.
So write the norm x squared. We now have proven that that is equal to norm t star x. And then that inner product in the middle is also equal to t star x, norm t star x squared. So you get t star, norm t star x squared minus 2 norm t star x squared plus norm t squared, or t star x squared. And that just equals 0.
Okay, let's see. So I'm seeing this one is one way of writing t star x squared, and we have a couple different ways of writing the norm of x squared, right?
Yeah, and so the norm of x squared is equal to the norm of t star x squared.
Okay.
Yes, because it's a fixed point. We use the fact that it's a fixed point.
But we're trying to prove that it's a fixed point, right?
Of t star. We use the fact that it's a fixed point of t.
Okay. All right.
And that gives us that the norm of t star x squared is equal to the norm of x squared.
Okay. So that's the bit I'm still not quite seeing. So that's
you already wrote it down.
I did. Okay.
Yeah. So norm x squared is equal to t star tx inner product t star tx, right? Because that's just ix.
No. That would be assuming that the T star is equal to T inverse.
Oh, okay.
Right. So whatever it's called, the unitary on its image, then that would be true.
Okay.
Right. And then you'd have it. But I think what you will get is an inequality. From the fact that you have this norm.
Sure. I mean, it's going to be a.
Right. So.
But won't that make the adjoint bigger? Okay.
No, because the norm of the adjoint and the norm of the operator itself are the same. And so then you are essentially done, I guess. So this is saying that this norm is less than or equal to this norm of x squared minus 2 times the norm of x squared, because that's what you worked out with this, that this middle term is, right?
Yeah, okay, I see.
Plus the norm of x squared. And so this means, since this is greater than or equal to 0, this has to actually be an equality.
Right.
So then you're going to get an equality there. And then you'll be done. Right. Okay. So that's where restriction on the norm of the operator comes in.
That makes more sense.
Very good. Yeah. Okay. Right. So everyone, I guess, was essentially correct. You have to plug this in and try it, the expansion, then you have to figure out where to use the fact here that you have a bound on the norm of the operator. Okay, great. What about B? Did anyone think about B? Mm-hmm. And it's an is it. Both of them are is it. So what's the answer to them? But let's start with whether it's true or false. So is the first one true or false? Okay, let me label them A and B. Which one is, for A and B, are they true or false? And, you know, the first thing I would do is, So let's take a little show of hands. So how many people think that this is actually true? So let's use the yes or no. Just a yes for true and no for false. For A, we have that seems to be a majority saying no here. All right, and why not? We just did an example.
The shift operator.
Right. And that's why the reason that it's such a good one to have in mind, because you can just throw it at these things. So this fails for the shift operator. Okay. Yeah, it's also false for finite dimensional ones. Right. So it's, yeah, so there are a bunch of examples where it's false. Okay, and what about this B? Maybe we could vote on that one too. How many people think that one's a true? Yeah, that one's true. And this is the one that you can just write out like you just said, or you could almost just assert that one as a theorem. Okay. Any other questions about this one? So here's an example again where having some examples in mind helps speed things up. Okay, let's see. What have I got next here? It's another good fact to know, and here they're actually asking you to show it. So just to get started here, if it's unitary, what does that tell me about the no, it's a stronger statement. So the norm of the shift operator was one, but the shift operator has a larger spectrum. It's in the entire unit disk, and here we want it just to be on the circle itself, just things where the norm is equal to one. Unit circle, set of all lambda, such that the norm of lambda is just equal to one. So it's smaller set. But it's not that far off, actually. Not that far off. But for unitary, I guess, so that means that A inverse is equal to A adjoint. But maybe, actually, yeah, I don't know. Greg, did you have a more elaborate argument than what I interpreted to mean? Yes. That would work, right? So enough to show. If the norm of lambda is less than one, then A minus lambda I inverse exists. Okay, so does anyone have any thoughts on either how to do this piece or some other approach to getting the spectrum on the unit circle? Okay, so what can we say about the spectrum of the inverse of an operator?
One over spectrum.
Right. Which just means instead of all the one over lambdas, it's the lambdas in the spectrum. And what does that give us in this setting?
If you had something in the spectrum that was in strictly inside the ball, then for the inverse, it would be outside the ball, but it can't be because it's the adjoint.
Right.
It's the same.
Exactly. Yep. Because this is equal to just the spectrum bar. Okay. So, if the normal lambda is less than one and lambda is in a spectrum of A, then 1 over lambda is in the spectrum of A inverse, but the norm of A inverse equals the norm of A star equals 1, and so we get one. Yeah, so basically whatever your spectrum is, it's got to be stable under taking the inverse and then conjugating it, and that set is the circle. Assuming it's less, norm is less than equal to one. Okay, any questions, any thoughts about that one? Is that one clear? It's also a good one just to know, because it's a useful fact. Okay, let's see, we've got a little more time. Let's try another. I have a whole bunch here, so keep going. So here's one we're looking at. Facts about the resolvent sets of the complement of the spectrum. All right, so let's take a couple minutes to look at this one. Okay, let's see, are people getting anywhere with either of these parts? Okay. All right, did anyone try that and get it to work?
Mm-hmm. I tried that and I'm not seeing it yet.
Okay. Anyone else? Oh, yeah, sorry. So, yeah, so Milo says it worked. All right. Yeah, okay, that's a good point. So I think once we've got someone who's got a solution, we can try writing it out and see where that restriction comes in. So you mean the restriction on the difference between nu and mu related to the norm of R? Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. Well, let's see, so did someone have a fairly clean way to write out the algebra that we can write up here?
I could try and say it. I have it written.
Okay.
So you start with the equation R V equals all this stuff. The one you're supposed to show.
Okay.
And then the first step is to multiply on the right by mu minus a.
Okay. Let me write u for mu, because it's shorter, and v for mu. Okay, all right, very good. Okay, and so you're going to multiply both sides by the u minus a, okay?
Yeah, to clear the resolvent for u.
Okay, and so we have a u minus a over here. Okay, and so these cancel, all right?
Yeah, so now you, under the assumption, I guess, you can invert both sides.
Okay, so now invert.
That's what's going on with the assumption, you can invert both sides.
Okay.
And then you
so let's see, so then we have
the order flip, right?
Yeah, order flip. So we have RU RV inverse.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the right we have I minus U minus V RU, right?
Yeah. I think there was probably a faster way to do this, but this works. So okay. You do that, and then now you're going to multiply on the left by RU inverse.
Okay.
I think we're doing some redundant stuff, but that's okay.
That's okay. Whatever works. Okay, so RU inverse minus, and this is just a number, right?
Yeah.
So it commutes. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. So now you have that the R inverse V, or RV inverse, is just V minus A, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so if we can show that the other side is just V minus A, we're okay. And
and it is, right? So this is a U minus A minus U minus V.
Mm.
Right. Right. Okay. So just algebraically formally, it seems to work. So then one has to think through where did we make an assumption to be able to do that? And as you said, you did an inversion at some point, right?
Yeah.
So you had to make sure that inverse is possible. And mm-hmm. and that should be where this second condition is coming in, right? Because let's see, this is the thing you ended up with as the inverse, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right, and so that should be right. So this should imply that. I minus U minus V RU is invertible. And, or maybe, well, I'm getting my signs mixed up, I guess. But let's see. I'm sorry. Is that right? Well, anyway, it's something like that. And how do you get the inverse to an operator like that? So that was something I mentioned at the beginning. You use the Neumann series, right? So this is invertible if and only if the Neumann series, which is going to be the sum of this right-hand side to the n, is the inverse. And that's the inverse if and only if it's strongly convergent. Okay, so that's a straight up norm invariant. Right, so as long as this norm is less than one, then you're okay. Okay, so up to getting some minus signs in the right places, then this is exactly the right condition that you need to do your inversion. Does that make sense? Should I write it out again? Maybe I write one more time to see if it's clear. So let me just call it another operator. If the norm of k is less than one, identity minus k inverse is equal to the limit as n goes to infinity of the sum n equals 0 to capital N of k to the n, and this limit is in operator norm topology. So that's what you can use to get that the inverse exists. Okay. Okay, any other comments or questions about this one? Oh, this has a name. This is a Neumann series. Okay, let's see, this is 2 minutes, but let's just take a quick peek at what the other problems are that I have listed here, and I'll put them, well, they're up already online, but let's just immediately see if people have comments about how to do it rather than trying to do the whole thing due to the lack of time. But yeah, we just have 3 minutes. So does anyone have sort of any immediate comments about this one? Whether it looks tricky or straightforward?
That one looks pretty straightforward, just computation.
I think you're right. I think that's pretty much exactly what it is, right? I think it's there mainly because it's a sort of a fun example of a situation where, yeah, so actually, what's the computation going to be for number 3? How are you going to find the spectral radius of T?
Use B and the spectral radius formula.
Yeah, that's right. So you'll say that it's the limit as n goes to infinity of the norm of T to the n 1 over n. So this is one of those cases where you actually need that limit because you get this R sitting out here. Okay, other thoughts about this one? Okay, let's look at what else I have here. So I don't know. I just wanted to play with any thoughts immediately about whether anything tricky is going on here, or if you can just kind of start running with it. So we have our sequence of operators. They all have the same spectrum. So we got some lambda in here. We want to show that lambda is still in the spectrum in the end, right? So it's some sort of continuity statement. Okay. Actually, could the spectrum jump in the limit? Anyway, that's something to play with, is whether it can. It can, actually. Okay, and so then I just had one more, so let's look at it. So okay, any thoughts about this one?
For the previous one, I think an example of having more spectrum as in the limit would be something like if you have just polynomial like 1 and then 1 plus x and then 1 plus x squared, and the limit would be 1 over 1 minus x, which will have 0 in a...
I see, okay. All right, it's a good example to play with, okay? Okay, and let's see, just have a few more seconds. So so then on this last one, actually this is a popular operator, which this one here Again, this is another integral operator. Is that clear? What the kernel is?
The characteristic function of 0x?
Exactly, yeah. So in other words, x less than y. All right, and then t is just integral operator with kernel f, right? So it's an example of one of these integral operators, and it's a specific example that one is familiar with. And so we already worked out when these things have eigenvalues and how to see that they're bounded. And then finally, this is another case where we're looking at this formula. And this time we'll use it backward, right? We know that that limit is equal to the spectral radius, so we just have to figure out the spectrum and then we're done, okay? All right, out of time. Any thoughts or comments? All right, very good. Well, enjoy the weekend and feel free to email me if you have any suggestions. But otherwise, at this point, I'll come up with a topic for Monday, and otherwise we'll do something fairly similar to what we've done this week. Okay. All right, then see you on Monday.